Welcome to First Baptist Rock Hill. Whether this is your first time joining us online or if you've worshiped with us before, we are thrilled that you've chosen First Baptist. It is our hope that you feel connection during this time today. We hope that you feel connected through the music, in the sermon, and maybe even fellowship with other believers. If you wish to learn more about First Baptist and the ministry opportunities available, check out our website at fbcrockhill.org or visit any one of our social media platforms. Enjoy.
Well, good morning. I am excited to be back here with you guys again. I think this is year number 5 that I've been here with you guys, and so it makes me feel like I've gone all the way through high school, like with you, and like graduating or something. You know, like I guess doing something right. Maybe one day when they're tired of having someone talk about family, they'll bring somebody else in. Who knows? But it is, in all sincerity, it is such a privilege. Being here, I get to travel full-time all around the country and internationally, and this is literally, it's like top of my list. I look forward to coming here every year, and I really wish I lived closer just so I could spend more like relational time with Steve and hire somebody else. Good grief. But seriously, it really is a joy, and there are so many good things happening around here, and I'm glad I get to vicariously be a part of it each year. And there's been a lot of changes in our family this year as well. My wife, I didn't mention this other service, is my wife is in grad school right now. She decided at 57 to go to grad school, and my job is to say, yay, rah, go for it, you know? That's retirement money. Go for it. Yes. But anyway, she's in grad school and, of course, doing amazing. And my daughter just finished her master's degree and doing amazing. She's her third year of teaching high school English right now. This is my kid who has dyslexia and is now teaching honors English because God has a sense of humor. And then my son just got married this year. So there's been just a whole lot of change. And so, you know, now we are, I have my fourth book just came out 2 weeks ago. So something good happening with me as well. And I think I have people everywhere I go, people, now that my kids are almost 29 and 26, they're always asking me, hey, when are you going to write a book on parenting your adult child? And I always give the same answer, and that is never. Like, honestly, I don't know who could possibly write the book. Like, if someone wrote it, I would look at it and go, whatever. Because none of us know what we're doing. We honestly don't. Like, I enjoyed every phase of parenting. I really did. Like, I loved it when they were little and just precocious and just adventurous and, you know, just discovering life. And I loved it when they got to middle school and their brains went to sleep and didn't work anymore. And, you know, I loved it when they got to high school and their brains woke up and they were getting get to have real conversations, and you know, it was just amazing. Went to college and celebrated all that and all those big choices, and then all of a sudden they hit adulthood, and I'm like, I have no idea what to do. Like, honestly, I mean, anyone relate? Like it feels like you're all, as a raising adult child, you're constantly just watching something happen going, I don't think it's gonna happen the way you think it's happening. I wouldn't keep doing that if I were you, but you can't say any of that. You're just like watching it. I feel like I'm the penguin on Madagascar, just going, just wave and smile, boys. Wave. That's like, that's my job now. Just wave and smile, you know? And it's wild. And so instead, the one thing I control, I'm living with one person now. And so we're trying to learn how to, you know, relearn each other. And we're dating again. And we went on a date a couple days ago downtown and went to the museum and out to dinner. And on the way home, she was asking me about our daughter's high school and where it's located. And she's always trying to figure out the city. And I can go someplace once and I never need directions again. Like, I don't have to have directions to get here from Chattanooga. I just know the way, you know? And so yeah, we're downtown, and I said, well, we're going to go down. You would go down to Main Street and then turn left on Main, and you're going to go up like 3 blocks. And right before you hit the railroad tracks, like, the school is right there on the left. And she put her hand on my arm and she goes, I think it's so cute how you talk to me like I know where I'm going. Like I love the woman, but I'm not trying to throw her under the bus, but if I dropped her off a half a mile from home in any direction, she would starve before she found her way home. Like it's really that bad. And she would tell you herself it's that bad. Like, you know, she has like emergency kits in the car in case anything happens. She's like, I have my emergency granola bars in case something happens. I have to trek home, you know. You know, we're just very different people when it comes to that. And I remember my son now and daughter, they're making these choices it's pretty crazy. Like I remember my son when he was like 10 and we were at a family get together for Christmas. And this is back when my dad was still alive, and we would all get together for Christmas Eve morning and celebrate. And then afterwards, we'd go to our extended family's, my aunt and uncle's house out in the country about 20 minutes away. And so there was about, you know, a dozen of us at our immediate family and then about 40 plus at the extended family. And so we're all gathered together, and then it's kind of like getting everyone in the car to leave to go to extended family. It's kind of like the movie Home Alone, where you're, you know, trying to huddle everyone together and make sure everyone is where they're supposed to be before you take off. And so we're in the car driving to my uncle's house, and my phone rings, and it's my mom and dad's like landline, and I'm like, that's weird. Like, who could be calling? And I said, hello? And I hear this little 10-year-old boy voice go, hey, Dad? And I'm like, Bailey? And I look in the rear view mirror, and he's not there. And I was like, Bailey, where are you? And he goes, I'm at Mimi and Granddad's. Where are you? And I was like, we're on the way to go have Christmas. And now my son, he is like the fearful one. Like, he does not like risk or anything like that. And he's been raised in church his whole life. And I promise, one of his fears growing up is like the rapture was going to happen and he's going to get like left behind. And so now he comes out of the bathroom and the house is empty. And he's like, I better call and make sure that I'm still okay, you know? And he's like lost. And I, you know, and in that regard, in that situation, it's so easy to turn the car around and go back, you know, and pick him up because he's been left behind. He's lost. But, you know, now he's 29 and there's choices being made that I'm like, I can't turn the car around. You know, we're just going to have to like, let this one play out and see what happens. And every one of our kids, no matter, I know looking at this audience, you're very different than the last audience. And, you know, a lot of you in this room, you got young ones, you got middle schoolers, high schoolers. How many of you here have like young adults in your home or raising? You got a whole lot of different ones, huh? Yeah. You guys sit in the same seats last year. I remember you right there. And right there in the spit section. So you know, we're in all over the board, all over the map here in this room, raising kids at all different places, and they're going to experience three different kinds of lostness in their life. And one of those lostness is like this idea of just like reckless wandering, where they're just trying to figure out life and they experiment with things and they're gonna try relationships here and they're gonna, you know, try to figure out how what a work ethic is and after school get-togethers and this friend group over here and that friend group over there, and they're just kind of wandering around, and some of that wandering ends up leading into lostness. You know, like you end up wandering, and it's not even intentional. It's not like they were trying to walk away from their faith or anything like that, you know, but maybe they went off to college. And for the first time in their life, they were challenged with some things about faith, and that wandering led to an abandonment of what they were taught growing up. Matter of fact, there was a study that came out of Fuller Theological Seminary a few years ago in which they tracked over 1,000 regular church-going high schoolers being raised in a nuclear family, like by a biological mom and dad. So they're looking for a very specific type of student, right? Because they thought, if there's anyone that has a possibility of making it out of high school into adulthood in their faith intact, it's going to be a regular church-going student with a mom and dad. So they tracked over 1,000 of them. Now, I'm guessing your church is not unlike other, you know, like just regular, good, healthy Baptist churches. And so I want you to imagine that Grant, your student pastor here, and matter of fact, you got a new student pastor, Colin, and that's in Colin, that, what? Corey, I apologize. Corey, that if you've seen kind of a tall, stocky guy here with wide eye that doesn't know what's behind every door, like that's him. So please help him out, you know. And he's working with your high school and college age students. And so I want you to imagine they've got like 100 high schoolers. And then those 100 high schoolers are going to graduate. If you go to the next slide, please. Those 100 high schoolers are going to graduate, and they're going to go off into college. Some of them are going to go into adulthood, and they're going to start like adult life. Now, of those 100 that graduate out of your church ministry, we know that statistically, roughly, can we go to the next slide, please? Roughly 50% of them are going to walk away from their faith. Now, how do you like knowing that you've got a 50% success rate of a student going from ninth grade through 12th grade? They're plugged into small group. They're going to camp. They're going to all those different things. Go to the next one, please. And that 50% of them are going to walk away from their faith. Now, for the first time ever, they actually wanted to interview the students who walked away from the faith to find out why, like what happened to you. And what they found out was that roughly 20% of them said, I never wanted it to begin with. Like, this is not for me. I was just biding my time to get out from underneath my mom and dad so I could go live my own life. But 80% of them, next slide, please, that 80% of the 50% that walked away from their faith, 80% of them said, I don't know how I got here. Now just let that settle on you for a second. 80% of them began to make choices and experience conversations and question things to such an extent that they walked away from the faith of their childhood and adolescence, but yet they said, I don't know what happened. Now, I think what that tells us is we need to radically begin to rethink through our programming when it comes to our teenagers, to our young adults, our college age students in particular, that now Gen Z, if you don't know the term Gen Z, that's roughly like our 18 to 30 year olds, like the next generations of adults among in our generation, like growing up in the 80s, that our generation, it was about 75% were regular churchgoers. That when we got to adulthood would say that we were part of the Christian faith. Today, for the first time ever in our country's recorded history, over 50% of Gen Z says that they are a-religious, meaning they claim no religious affiliation at all. It's not just they're saying, I'm not Christian. They're saying, I don't want anything at all to do with church, nothing to do with any kind of faith group. That's mind-boggling. Like, what is happening? Like, their generation is so different from any generation that we've encountered. Like, we have to parent them different, talk about truth different. Like, they engage in relationships differently. Their work ethic, everything is different from them. So we cannot say, oh, I get you. I understand you as a teenager. Because we don't. It's a very different world for them. And so 80% of them are going to go, I don't even know how I got here. A second kind of wondering that your kids are going to experience are going to be just life circumstances. Just these unprovoked circumstances in life. It could be that caused them to walk away from their faith. It could be something like maybe a mom and dad getting divorced, and it just caused them to go into a depression, to experience anger. It could be like a move, like they move from one community and they move out of state to another community and they lost their friendships. They never got replugged into a new church again. It could be going from one school to all kind of just life circumstances that happened that it wasn't something that they did. It was just natural things that encountered in their life that led them to begin to spiral. I mean, spiral in a way that we do not understand as adults. For instance, going all the way back to the 1930s, the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, every year has polled tens of thousands of teenagers asking them about stress, anxiety, and depression. And what we know is that roughly 5% every year for the last 100 years, Roughly 5% of teenagers say that they struggle with persistent stress, anxiety, and depression. This last year, they released some new numbers for Gen Z. This is your teenagers, right? Now that they're saying that one out of four of all teenagers are saying that I daily struggle with stress, anxiety, and depression. We don't understand that. That's not part of how, that's not what we've experienced. And what it's done is they've gotten to such a place that they're going, the relationships that I used to have that felt safe aren't safe for me anymore. My faith that felt safe doesn't feel safe anymore. The things that once made sense don't make sense anymore. And it makes them feel like that mentally, emotionally, spiritually, everything is just spiraling around them and out of control. And the third kind of lostness is moral compromise. It's like intentionally saying, I'm intentionally walking away from this. Like what they end up doing exactly what we did when we were teenagers, and they invoke the just clause. You know what the just clause is, don't you? You remember it? It's where we say, those of us that were raised in faith ourselves, we say, hey, you know what? I know what God's boundaries are. I've been taught God's boundaries. I've been modeled God's boundaries. My mom and dad have walked with me through God's boundaries. But just this one time, I want to know what this feels like. Like just this one time, I want to date somebody like that. Like just this one time, I want to be touched this way. Just this one time, I want to taste this. Just this one time, I want to drink this. And they end up invoking it, the just clause, so many times that they're literally lost in the spiritual woods and can't find their way back home again. Like many of us in this room as adults, we remember living that ourselves, don't we? As teenagers and young adults. Like just thinking, I didn't intend that to happen, but yet that's where I am. And regardless of what it is that we experience, can we agree that those of us that are adults in this room, we have experienced all three of those in our life at some point, haven't we? Whether it's moral compromise or just hard life circumstances or just times of questioning that made you feel out of control, we've all experienced those. And can we agree our children are going to experience them as well? Yes? So my question is this. If we know they're going to experience all of those things and all of them make them feel lost, why do we spend almost all of our time focused on moral compromise? Why are we not spending more time on the mental health, the emotional health, the relational health? Why are we not spending more time on being relationally and spiritually connected so when they begin to wonder and question things, they know where home base is? And we spend so much of our time just focused on the morality of our kids. I think it's because that's what we can see, yes? It's measurable. It's in front of us. And somewhere along the way, we've convinced ourselves as parents and grandparents, even as like people in the church that work with our young people, we've convinced ourselves that our job is to be the sin moderators of teenagers. If we can just help them be a little bit less bad, then everything will be okay. I was doing a PTA. I've got to speak at over 200 public schools doing the parenting stuff just like this. And afterwards, I always love just listening to parents' stories and when they will come up and want to talk and, you know, say, hey, what is your name and how many kids do you have and how old is your oldest? And this mom said, oh, my oldest is 17. She's a senior this year. And I said, oh, that's got to be pretty exciting for you. And she said, yeah, if I can just get her out of here without getting pregnant, we'll be good. And I was like, that's your bar? Like, that's the standard for you? Like, how low have you set the bar, mom? You know? And that's what she's saying. She's just saying, like, if I could just navigate this so she can be just a little bit good, then we'll be okay. And I promise you, the standard in our home has never been goodliness. It has only ever been godliness. And that comes from reflecting the character and nature of Jesus. We've never, ever, ever taught our children a set of rules. We've only ever taught them the character of Jesus. That's where freedom comes from. Rules lead to bondage. Rules lead to rebellion. Jesus is freedom. Does this make sense? And so as often as possible, trying to help them understand the nature and the character of Jesus, because we know that they're going to experience all of these things. And Jesus himself, he's having this experience, this moment in Luke chapter 15. And by the way, I'm going to leave two stories out just to make sure I close on time, okay? So I'm a long talker. I don't know if you guys know it. Some of you, you walked in today and you saw me on stage and you were like, oh, buckle up, here he goes. Every year I miss lunch, you know? So Cracker Barrel is going to wait on me. Jesus is having this experience in Luke chapter 15 where he's sitting down and he's having a moment with what are called sinners and tax collectors. Basically, it's the way of saying he's spending time with the riffraff of the culture. He's hanging out with the social misfits. Like, I don't know about you guys, this teenager over here, they're all looking at your phones. I don't know about you guys, but like, I was the social misfit. I know I look like ruggedly, you know, handsome and debonair and like, you know, muscular and everything now, but I was the social misfit, okay? And so I was the one that I questioned everything. I just felt like I even a youth group didn't quite fit. And so I relate to a lot of these stories. And so Jesus is hanging out with these people that are called sinners and tax collectors. He would hang out with women. He's hanging out with prostitutes. He's hanging out with children. Like all these people that have no rights, that have no position in the culture, that's who Jesus is spending time with. And so now he's hanging out with them, and the Pharisees walk up. These are the sin navigators. They're the sin managers of the culture. And so the Pharisees walk up, and they're going, what are you doing? Why are you hanging out with these people? Because Jesus is a rabbi. Now, this is difficult for us because when we read stories in Scripture, we read them. We can't help it. We read them in the way that makes sense to us. And so, you know, I'm a white male American. You know, I can't escape that. It's just part of my genetics and my biology. You know, it's who I am. But that's not who Jesus is. And so I can't read it through my lens and try to make it make sense. I have to understand culturally what's going on. And so for him as a rabbi is like the mouthpiece of God to the Jewish people. In their culture, they have the authority. They and they alone are able to interpret the Mosaic law, the laws of God. And so Jesus is hanging out with this riffraff, these misfits, and the Pharisees are like, what are you doing? And then look at the story. Look in Luke 15. I was serious. We're going to skip just a little bit of this. And go ahead and go all the way to verse 11. There's two other stories really quickly. One is about a sheep. And it says there's a shepherd and he's got 100 sheep and one of them gets lost. And it says, well, Jesus says, what shepherd would not go find the lost sheep? And the reason why he goes to find the lost sheep is not just because he's a shepherd and it's his job. It's because the sheep are his livelihood. The sheep have great worth to him. It's his responsibility to take care of the sheep. And he knows where the lost sheep probably is. Because he knows where all the pitfalls are that the sheep could fall into. So he leaves the 99 in a safe space and goes to find it. And then the second story is about this woman who loses a coin of great value. And after she finds it, she celebrates the finding of this coin. And then it gets us to a story that we all have heard. I mean, no matter where you are in your faith journey, we've all heard the story. Because it's actually considered one of the greatest short stories in all of literature. And we call it the prodigal son. And because I was the social and church misfit, I never liked that word. You know, and prodigal literally means a squanderer of wealth. But that's not an original in the original language of the Bible. That's like a title we've put on the story. Like if we were going to give it a more accurate title, it should be called the lost son, like the lost sheep and the lost coin. But I want you to look in this passage with me and at least see maybe some new things that are going on culturally here that we've missed before that would apply to us as parents and grandparents. Starting at verse 11, it says, and Jesus said, there was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to the father, Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me. And he divided his property between the two of them. Now, there's already two things here that when Jesus would tell parables, matter of fact, if you read a parable And you go, well, that just doesn't make any sense at all. That's kind of the point, is parables are meant to be these almost preposterous stories that have a point at the end. And that, and it's kind of like, well, if it could work out in this ridiculous story, then what does that have to say about me as just like a normal person who's trying to like make it in my faith? Does that make sense? That's kind of what's going on in these stories. And so one, it says there's an older gentleman who has property, who has wealth, and his younger son comes to him and says, I want you to give me my inheritance. One, culturally, never going to happen. Yeah, that would never, a son would never come to his living father and say, give me what's due to me once you die. It would be such incredible disrespect to do that. The second thing that's happening there is the young son says, divide the inheritance between us. Never going to happen. Because as the younger son, he does not get half the inheritance. The older, according to Mosaic law, the eldest son always gets what's called a double portion of everything. A double portion of livestock, a double portion of land, a double stuff of monetary, anything of worth, he gets double what the younger one gets. Even if the father had five sons and he's going to divide it five ways, the oldest one gets double what any of the others get. It's part of what's called the birthright. All right. And so the younger son goes to the father and says, hey, just split it. It's like he's saying, not only am I going to disrespect you, I'm going to disrespect my oldest brother as well. We have no record of anywhere in Judaic history of this ever happening, like if any occurrence like this happening, because it would bring such disrespect to the family. And that's part of the point that Jesus is making is, hey, mom and dad, like sitting here with me, listening to me tell the story, could you imagine this ever happening? You know, and the parents are like, no, that would never happen. And then he goes on to say, so then the son, it says, not many days later, the younger son takes all of his inheritance and he took a journey into a far country. One translation says he went to live among the Gentiles. Holy smokes. Now we're really getting down to brass tacks. He went to live among the Gentiles because there's all kinds of regulations in the Mosaic law as a Jewish person, what you could and couldn't do with a Gentile. And it was basically nothing. Like you're not to be friends with them. You're not to do business with them. You're certainly not to marry them. And it tells us in one translation that he was in the far country with the prostitutes. Like he's thinking, like it's Jesus is trying to make this like as bad as it could possibly be, as if possible. I think part of the point is to say, hey, mom, like you think you got a rebellious kid? Let me tell you a story. As if like, are you telling me that your kid is this bad? Because none of us, our kid has ever been this bad, right? And that's kind of the point. It's saying how bad could you be that grace can't cover it? So then he says, he goes on and he says, but when he came to, so he went out and he hired himself. Let me go back. Sorry. The younger son gathered he had and he went to a far journey country and he squandered all of his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in the country and it began to be in need. Verse 15. And he went out and he hired himself out to one of the citizens in the country and he went into the fields to feed pigs. And while he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate him, no one would even give him anything. Like Jesus is saying, this guy has gotten so bad for him. He has none of his inheritance left. He doesn't have anything to eat pig slop with. He has nothing. And then he says, when he came to himself, he said, my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but yet I'm perishing here in hunger. Verse 18, I will arise and go to my father and I'll say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. So just treat me like one of your servants. And he arose and he came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And holy smokes, that would not happen. There is so much going on in that last verse that we just gloss right over because us being raised in American churches, we're like, oh, this loving father. He just loved his son so much. He just ran out to embrace his son. There's, for one, If you are a Jewish grown-up, grown child, you're in your 20s, and you've gone off to live with the Gentiles and engaged in all kinds of immoral activity among them. Now, as a Jewish person, you live not just your life differently. You live as a family differently and as a community differently. See, like you guys, I'm guessing the six of you here as teenagers, none of you even live in the same neighborhood probably, right? We live all over the city. Some of you like go to the same schools and you go to the same youth group, right? But you live all over the place because that's how we do life today in America. But back then, they lived in communities together their whole life. And what would happen is, as a grown person, if you left home to go be among the Gentiles, it's not just that you are living in shame, that you also are bringing shame upon your family, and you have brought shame upon your whole community. So now this son has come to his senses. He realized how bad life is, and he has decided he's going to humble himself and repent and go to his father. And it says, the father sees him. Now, there's three things that have to, one of three things have to happen. Like legally, by the law, one of three things has to happen to this son who has brought shame. One is either he's going to experience, it's what's called naduai. Naduai is, it's actually still practiced today in Judaism. And it is a temporary time of banishment, meant to where you could go and reflect on the bad things that you've done. It's usually between 7 and 30 days. Hey, you were disrespectful to your parents. For 7 days, you have to be away from everybody. Just go think about what you, it's kind of like your mom and dad sending you to your room and go think about what you've done, right? That's like this, right? But the second thing would be even elevated. It was called harem. And harem is an irrevocable banishment from the community, not just from your family, but from the community, and yet you've done something so bad to bring shame that you're gone. You cannot come back again. This is still practiced today in Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox communities. The third one was called Hazaza. And Hazaza, we don't have any record of it happening beyond the first century. So what that means is that it was still being practiced to some extent in Jesus' telling of the story, right? And the way Hazaza worked was this, that if you were a grown man, and specifically you went to live among the Gentiles, and you squandered your inheritance, and you came back home, the townspeople would get clay pots and fill them with stone or grain. And when they heard that you were coming, they would run out to the edge of the city, and they would throw down the pots. They would shatter the pots in front of you, and pick up the pieces and look at you and say, may what has happened to this pot happen to you because you've brought shame upon all of us. Like, I can't imagine. Like, I can understand why they don't do it anymore. That's so incredibly, like manipulative and shameful to do. I mean, like, shameful of the people doing it to the person that was in sin. But yet this is, one of these three things had to happen to him. He can't just come back home and everything's forgotten because he has shamed himself, his family, and his entire community. So now let's find out what's going on with the father. It says the father has gotten word that his son has come back home. So what does the father do? He runs out of his home. Again, things are happening here that we don't understand. A grown man, there was all kind of rules about when you could leave your property as the owner of the property. There was only certain days of the week, certain times of the season, certain times of the year you were allowed to leave your property because you're responsible for it as the elder, you know, authority over the property. But yet he leaves his home to go out to meet his son in the outskirts of the city. The second thing is this, he ran. A grown man, it was against the law for a grown man to run in public because to do so, you have to raise your tunic and expose your legs so you don't fall over. Does that make sense? Never going to happen. It would be shameful. It would be sinful for him to do that. But yet, what does the father do? He leaves his property and he brings basically sin upon himself, the judgment of others upon himself to go get to his son. Why is he running to his son? I don't think it's just because he loves his son. I think it's because he knows one of these three things has to happen to his son. There has to be penance made. And the father is running ahead of the townspeople, bringing their shame. And the father is saying, I'm going to run ahead of them so that I'm the first one there. And I'm going to cover my son's shame. And it says that he takes his cloak and puts it over his son. Like his robe is literally a symbol of his identity. It's like saying, this is what my family represents, my whole heritage represents. You know, can you remember the story from the Old Testament of Joseph and his coat of many colors? Remember his brothers despised him? One of the reasons they despised him is because his father gave him this special coat that represents the father's authority. And his older brothers are like, how dare you? And so now this father is taking this robe and saying, my son is being cloaked in my identity. I'm going to take my ring. My ring is my authority. And I'm putting it on my son. And then he tells his servants, hey, go prepare a feast. In their culture, when you eat a meal with someone, it is a cultural way of saying that we are in right relationship with one another, which is why they didn't eat with Gentiles. So as a Jewish person, when you ate with someone else, it's a way of saying our hearts, our relationships are connected. You and I, we're good. So the father is saying to everyone, we're throwing a party and we're going to eat because me and my son are in right relationship. Now, what it doesn't tell us in the story, well, does the son like embrace all the heritage and culture and rules of the Jewish culture again? We don't know. There's so much we're not told in the story, which is why I don't think that's the point of the story. I think the point of the story is what Jesus at the end, Jesus says that all of heaven rejoices when one who has strayed comes back and repents and is restored. And I think so many of us in this room, we have been fixated on managing our kids' sin, or for those of us who have adult children who have wandered off, who've become lost, we've prayed for so long against their sin and what got them to this place of wandering that we've forgotten how to celebrate. When the sheep was found, the shepherd celebrated. When the coin was found, the woman celebrated. When the son was lost and was brought back, they celebrated. So my question for you this morning is, are you ready to celebrate? That doesn't mean there's not consequences. It doesn't mean there's not new boundaries established. It doesn't mean that there's not going to have to be years and years of healing for true restoration to happen. But what I'm telling you is this, is that there will never be a day in my home in which the door is locked from my child. I can't imagine what would ever have to happen to do that. And I know some of us, I know I'm speaking in generalities and we all have different stories and different struggles, but I know we would agree, wouldn't we? You would lay down your life for that kid. There's nothing that they could do that would make you walk away from being their biggest cheerleader. You know, and sometimes you watch their train wrecks and man, you think, I wish I could take your place, and you can't. But my question is, are you ready to celebrate? Are you ready to lay down your own swords? Are you ready to lay down your own judgment, your own ridicule, your own shame? To just open the door, open your arms and say, welcome. Welcome home. If you're here to repent, I'm here to restore. Let's get the party started. You know, I think part of the way that happens is when we as parents just admit our own life mistakes. When we just live in a right relationship with our kids in such a way that we can say, I get it. I understand what you're going through. I'm not somehow better than you. We are all in spiritual journey, yes? And that journey is to be transformed into the image of Christ. And what that means is when my daughter was 9 years old and gave her life to Jesus, Scripture says that, boom, at that moment, she became a new creation. And every single day, the Holy Spirit has been at work in her just as he is in me. We are both in different places in that journey, but we're both on the same journey. And your child, who maybe be in their 20s, and they're off to college and they don't want to come back home again. Maybe they're in their 40s and they've given you a grandchild and they're like, I don't want anything to do with this anymore. You know, if there was a day in their life, a moment in time where they said, I recognize that my sin separates me from God, and I choose to embrace the forgiveness and redemption afforded to me in Christ to be my forever Savior, then boom, you know who they belong to. And you don't have to be afraid. We can grieve the lost years. We can grieve the lost time. But I don't have to be afraid, because greater is he who lives in them than he that is in the world. Yes? And so are you ready to celebrate? This morning we're gonna end our time a little bit differently. And I know that there are some of us in this room that you have a lost one in your home. And I don't know how long they've been lost and wandering. I don't know if they are a sheep that's just made some foolish choices. I don't know if they're a coin that's just gone through some hard circumstances. I don't know if your kid is like the lost son and has just willfully walked away. But regardless of what the circumstances is, there is nothing that grace cannot cover. And there is always hope. And this morning, we want to take a moment and just pray for you. And so, I don't know how old your child is, if they're a grown-up or they're still in adolescence, or maybe they've given you a grandkid and they're pretty old now. But if you've got someone in your family that they're the lost one, would you just raise your hand? Just raise it high. And the rest of us, we just want to look around the room, and you just recognize one of those people with their hands raised. And we just want to take some time this morning and just pray for them. Can we do that? I know we're going to go eat lunch in a minute here, but can we just pray for the lost ones this morning? For the rest of us, maybe we want to take a moment and, man, if you're sitting next to your teenager, sitting next to your kid right now, maybe just lay your hand on them. Just pray for God's protection. Pray that God would just equip you to be their shepherd as you follow the heavenly shepherd.